モタサン、バガワト、アラハト、サンマ、サンブッタサ。ナモタサン、バガワト、アラハト、サンマ、サンブッタサ。ナモタサン、バガワト、アラハト、サンマ、サンブッタサ。ブタン、ダマン、サンガン、ナマサン。Okay, so I'm just going to go through some of what you are asking here. Without preparation, so it's just whatever comes up. How to be free of time conditioning? Mostly, I have a feeling that everything runs so quickly. Many obligations and duties, things have to be done. It reminds me of my mother. In that sense, my dear beloved mother has this very conventional habit of always making this comment, not particularly when I visit my parents. A few days into the visit, the comments come, "Oh, time is passing so quickly, you know. Soon you're gonna go away again." And I just roll my eyes. Well, you know, as sons do, time is just you know, it's just not time. Just runs at its own pace. You know, funny enough, I don't seem to have that problem. I don't know. I don't feel time runs quick or slow. Sometimes I feel time runs slow, maybe because I have one of those hyperactive minds. And then, you know, if things go too slow, you're impatient. Sure. I mean, this is a psychological aspect of time, isn't it? How do the English say time flies when you enjoy yourself? And so I sometimes use that one. Sure. But I don't think from a practice point of view, I have that much to say about it, then rather than we always can, of course, recognize that statement. It's quite natural. But yes, to one thing to contemplate this part of to use that as a contemplation, how we judge time, you know, it's very clear from our psychological conditioning and from our preferences. You know? Obviously, when if I feel very busy and I have other things to do, think it is. It's like that. You know? If you really enjoy ourselves, then that's always going too quick. You know? And how is it on the other hand when you know we are having to wait for something that we want to do, and you know things don't go quick enough, then sometimes time seems to really slow down. That's just a psychological thing, of course. And we can see that. And like all those things, you know, how we distort our perceptions, when we can see that's what, you know, awareness it's useful for, you know, if you're mindful of doing that, we have a perspective on it and we can laugh about it as well, you know, if you're so inclined. We don't have to take it so serious. And then there is just this investigation into time, of course, itself, time and timelessness. As I like that, so that's the meditative approach. And sure, also something that I use, so I contemplate. You notice usually in guided meditations, I always end with the kind of an open focus and notice change. You know, noticing the constant change of the content of our experience. All those, and then notice against that change the sense that like that's what we call the flow of life, isn't it? The stream of life, the stream of our experience. The stream of life, you call it, isn't it? It's, like life flows. It's a representation of that change, which sometimes seems too quick, sometimes seems too slow, but life never flows anywhere, doesn't it? The stream of life, because it's always here. No, and that's something that we can directly connect to, that I'm never anywhere else. I might like to be somewhere else sometimes, but I'm always here. I can't escape myself. And the same applies, of course, for time. This famous, you know, saying about here and now, isn't it? That we're always here in spiritual circle, we have to be here now, everything's here now. But that, as a direct experience, that's this kind of thing. It's always now. We've got this little painted clock down on the notice board, down there, isn't it? Which has got all the times it always says now, 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 now. It's always now. You know? Whenever, you know, whatever the clock says, or whatever, you know, the you know, mechanical kind of chronicle time says, psychological, it's always now. And that is true, that we can use that, or it can be an important insight that we can have. So this conditioning that we have in of psychological time. Mm. Krishnamurti speaks about that sometimes. When I do remember, it's one of the texts or passages that I remember, where he talks about psychological time. Mm. He talks about how he says desire and self and time, psychological time, they're always born together. He uses this example about you're going through a shopping center with your mask on. And so you're looking into the shop windows, and you know, you might be oblivious of time, you're just daydreaming away maybe or whatever, and you just walk around, and then you look into a shop window and it's a jeweler, and there you see a really classy, beautiful watch. And you see this watch, nothing untoward is happening yet, but suddenly in your mind this image comes up of you wearing that watch, right? And how cool that would look like, and how you would show all your friends your new watch. And that's, you know, and see, in this moment, this psychological moment, you know, this is born in your mind, the sense of self, me, with a desire of me wanting that watch, how I would be, you know, my self-image of me with that watch in the future, of course. But it all comes up, the psychological time, and the need, the feeling that of wanting a watch, needs somebody who wants that watch. That's going to be me, you know, has this image. So the desire. And then with that, of course, also this tension comes into play, with the psychological tension around time, that now I haven't got this watch. So I project this future, and maybe I can't wait. So then time runs very slow until I finally, you know, I got in the queue and I finally get to the counter where I can ask about this watch. You know, see how this is a whole psychological construct. You know, that's what the Buddha talked about, how we create the world, how the world manifests in our mind. You know? And then the jeweler tells us the price for the watch, and that's when death happens, right? Because psychological death, because then you realize you will never be able to afford this watch. You know, it's a Swiss watch. Here, where I'll see the advertisement of all the Swiss watches in the airport, isn't it, in Zurich? There's all those wonderful Swiss watches, and you know, you will never be able to. Well, I don't have any money anyway, but you know, whatever. Or who would ever pay that much money for a watch? But you know, that's how people come to Switzerland, just to get an expensive watch, isn't it? If you're one of those. Probably none of you, but I don't know. So, that's one way in which the Buddha talks about, in my interpretation, certainly, in the dependent origination of the death of me. It's not necessarily physical death, but the death of that self-image. No, so the desire, tanha, leads to upadana. And then the next step in the dependent origination is upadana leads to bhava, which is becoming. Tanha, upadana, becoming, and then the next thing is birth. No, one interpretation, traditional interpretation, is that this is over three lifespans. You know how that's your desire in this life conditions the birth in the next life, but I think it's generally quite accepted that actually the most useful application of this is really as a description of this psychological birth of me, the image of me, and it needing this watch. Mm-hmm. And has to do with desire. It's fueled by that desire. And time, psychological time, comes in there. No. And then comes a disappointment, the death. So this image just has to die. It's not going to happen. Me and my watch and, you know, showing off with my friends. So I'm dejected. I'm going to go out. And then something else is going to take hold. You know, a new psychological self is born. Maybe you come up with schemes about how you're going to get this money, you know, and then the bank robber might be born if you're very unskillful, and so forth. No, life just moves on like that, you know, from one psychological birth to the next. And you can see how cycles of time, psychological time, are woven into that. some of those psychological cells might be suffering over time, be going much too slow. No, if you want to get something, you can't get to it. As also psychological self-images will be suffering from time running too fast, like my mother, you know, and first time runs too slow until her son is actually finally coming to visit again. And then suddenly time, you know, seems to speed up. It's really mean, isn't it? All year just goes kind of slow and you know, it's a dredge. And then suddenly for these 2 weeks, it just goes by like nothing, isn't it? How does that happen? And so this constant return actually and realization of awareness again, it's this awareness just solves everything. That's what I'm gonna say, isn't it? Because when you notice awareness again, it just always brings you back into now. And that's that time really dies in some ways. Psychological time dies, the tension goes out. And yes, I mean, that's, I think, I don't know, there might be more that's available to us, but that's a kind of timelessness that is, that from my limited experience is something that we can really touch into. And which it's an aspect of this awareness and abiding as awareness being so liberating, is that we get out of this tension of the psychological time. Interestingly enough, temporarily, you know, these glimpses of timelessness are usually time bound. They're kind of experience that don't last usually for us very long. You know, a really conscious kind of deep basing into that. But while that happens, I think that feels kind of very real. You know, not that suddenly chronological time disappears, it's because there's still change. You can observe change and it works. But you realize this very strong realization that experience is always now. You know? And that can become quite powerful. Even your fear of death, you just realize you can think about death, which is always in the future. Or just realize it's something that's happening now. When is death ever going to happen? As long as you can contemplate it, it's not here, isn't it? Whenever it's now, you're alive. Of course, and the Buddha is right. Consciousness just being a continuous process that goes beyond the death of the body, then just witnessing the body falling apart, which, you know, for more descriptions, that's certainly very powerful. But conscious experience keeps going, keeps flowing, and it's always going to be now. You know, depending what our experiences sound a bit abstract, but like with many of the liberated aspects of awareness, even this perhaps our so-called common and garden variety, I think we can get a taste or a glimpse of that, you know, in like in meditation, and just realize, you know, I'm still here now. No. Did I talk to you at some time that was called 2 o'clock in the afternoon? I seem to have a memory, which I have now. Was it me? Was it the same me? Was it a different me? I have memories from when I was 4 years old. And as in some ways, it seems very strange, very different, like a different person, isn't it? It's like, what do I have to do with it? And yet on the other hand, there's one element that is very familiar, which is like, it has still the same taste, this taste of now. That was one thing, even that as a 4-year-old, of course, in some ways, I hope and trust, you know, I was kind of, as a personality, I was quite different. I have evolved since then, for good or for bad. But some core element that tastes the same, this taste of now experience is always, whatever was happening to me, things that I remember, some traumatic kind of things, it's the same thing. It like it happened in this space, which is now. And it's still the same. It feels still the same. Well, it hasn't changed. But so it's just a few reflections on that. So this including actually positively contemplation, isn't it? That the one that I actually use. No? Also with things like visiting my parents or with people. I don't like departures, for example. I find that it was difficult, you know, saying goodbye and all the emotions come up. But you cannot contemplate them. And it's a part of a conscious contemplation that I do. Like even that is also to realize this is still, it's happening now. And now I'm here and I'm sitting in the train back to Switzerland and I connect to this. It's still now. It's still now. It's just the content that's changing. But does consciousness ever go anywhere? Who knows? And then George asks, could I say a few words about the external aspects of the mindfulness practice? It seems to be a crucial part, but it is not taught. If you look at the Satipatthana Sutta, it always talks about, on all the four foundations of mindfulness, it talks about observing internally and externally. So that's where the question is coming from. So observing the body. Now, with every section, the sutta goes through kind of a refrain, which goes through the same motions, and the same combinations. It is a characteristic in general for much of the suttas. I think it's also maybe a characteristic of oral tradition, because it works a lot with repetition and having fixed kind of schemes, because it makes it easy, of course, to remember. You know that if you learn chanting by heart, as we have to do, it helps a lot, you know, to have recognizable patterns that in order to kind of memorize, you know, how it works, so you can orient yourself. And I think partly sometimes you feel it's a structural element, because sometimes you notice these repetitive patterns, sutta going through the motions of the repetition, but sometimes it's really hard to make sense of it. I don't have an example at the moment at hand, but sometimes you have that where you come to and say, well, what's that supposed to mean? And then you notice, well, this is just part of a scheme. It just goes through the same pattern. It's just different items. And with some items, the first ones is very obvious. And then with some of the other items, it just somehow doesn't quite fit anymore. So sometimes it might just be a structural element. So you don't always have to feel forced to kind of make sense of all of it. As in general, of course, even the Buddha said, you know, just pick up with his teachings what is useful to you and what you can make sense of. Don't dismiss the rest, because that you can't make sense of it might not necessarily mean that it's not sensible. It might just be that you're not yet quite, you know, ready to take it in and understand. And now, then, if you have read commentaries and interpretations of the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's main discourse on mindfulness, like, for example, the excellent books by Anala Yubiko, German monk. So he wrote some modern classics, you know, about Satipatthana. I think the first one is just called Satipatthana. And then he did a couple of follow-ups, one more scholarly, where he compares the Satipatthana Sutta and the Pali Suttas with the Chinese kind of canon and the Tibetan one, and makes some comparative studies. And the third one, which is interesting, which is more practical, which is from his personal way of teaching Satipatthana in retreats, so where he takes more kind of examples, is not so complete, you know, not a complete explanation of the whole sutta, but more practical applications and things like that. They're quite worth reading those books, particularly in the original Satipatthana book. Of course, he also tries to explain this aspect or this passages where they talk about looking at things externally. And certainly you can make sense of it if you look at looking at the body awareness. You can practice this internally. You can observe other people's bodies. I think partly it gets not taught that much because it's not so relevant, I think, for our own practice in terms of understanding the nature, the structure of our experience, of our reality, how we contribute in creating our world and how we the suffering into there. To me, it seems to be more like maybe a minor kind of extra point. I might be wrong on that, of course, but more to do with the capability of reading other people, you know, and some people are, of course, very skilled at it. We do it, obviously, of course, actually all the time, you know, as psychologists say, what is it, verbal communication only makes up for some fairly small percentage of our communication. So a lot we pick up cues about body language, obviously facial expressions, very important. We communicate through all kinds of things. We're communicating our state of mind all the time, whether we want it or not. It's good to remember, no? Even if you keep your mouth shut and you don't say anything. Other people are still able to pick up a lot. And you learn a lot about that if you live in communities that I live. You know, I look at my fellow monks and it can have a strong impact on me, just a facial expression. I don't have to say very much. There's a lot is communicated, you know, of physical body language. And that's, of course, a way of practicing mindfulness of the body externally, obviously. And one can train in that. you know, the experience if you go through body therapists, no, of different kind of schools, a physiotherapist or something like that. They just say, oh, we'll just walk through the room. And it's just amazing. Sometimes you think what they pick up. I have seen quite a few, and you might sometimes even suspect they make it up, isn't it? I mean, how can that be? You know, I just walk into the room and tell them, well, you this and this and that. And that. But it's, of course, just trained observation. You know, just a few body movements, you can read a lot and imagine where things, you know, might be badly arranged in the body through bad habits of body posture. That's an example, no? For using mindfulness of the body externally. But I certainly think in terms of satipatthana practice for practicing for freedom from suffering, it's a secondary, it takes second place, I think, in importance, not first place. I do remember from like also from Bhikkhu Bodhi or Bhikkhu Anālayo, for example, the third foundation of mindfulness, the mind. Of course, there comes in the whole speculation about, you know, mind reading and all that. No, often the suttas talk about the Buddha and some of his chief disciples, you know, having this capacity about knowing what's going on in other people's mind. And that has what, you know, would supposedly be indicated by, you know, practicing mindfulness of the mind of other people, to most of us not readily accessible. And then you can speculate about it, how, you know, how you can, again, do that by just picking up signs from the body, no? And it is still, you know, exists in us. There's certainly a lot of living monks. I don't know about nuns. I mostly know about monks, but in Thailand has a reputation of being able to read people's minds and makes people very careful around them. So it could be, can be quite skillful, you know, if you're with a person like that in the room, then you should be very cautious about what, you know, thinking any naughty thoughts. If you know that some kind of supposedly, you know, very powerful master knows what's going on in your mind. Some monks kind of some kind of view set, so you go live with somebody, so because it helps you, gives you an external authority to help you with your own restraint, you know. Because you feel embarrassed, you know, about what you think maybe when these monks are around. So you can use it in that way in your practice. So the external practice seems to be crucial since it could displace the self-cherishing and self-view arising in internal practice. I think ultimately it's more like actually the internal practice displaces really the self-view if you do it properly, because you come to the point where you realize there isn't anybody here actually, at least not the way we usually think about it. From the point of awareness, there is no internal or external, because it's all in the mind, it's all in awareness. So that's like with many of those things, there is and there isn't, you know, we realize it makes some sense, you know, for communication to speak about external things or internal things. But if you look at it directly in terms of our experience from awareness, it becomes fuzzy because of our awareness, where's the boundary, you know, what is internally, what's external. But part of the insight, I think, experience of where awareness becomes suddenly very strong reality for oneself, like the sense of presence, is precisely that this gets turned like weirdly inside out, you know, because it challenges our usual assumption. That is what, you know, philosophers call our naive realism, isn't it? That we always assume ourselves as being this figure walking around in a world of real things out there until we examine it a bit and just realize, well, you know, it's not quite like that. That's the way that our mind helps to construct. It's like a world that is related to something is obviously objectively real, because it's a shared kind of world. It's not something that I can just invent any way which I like. You know, if I just think the only thing edible in my world is bricks, I'm not going to survive for very long. It's not going to work. So it has to work well enough with the outward pressures of what is actually there. But the way I experience the world is, of course, through my senses. And they have to do with this subject, you know, this being. If I've got something is a bit wrong with my eyes, then I see things different, and I can't even see, not for sure how, you know, whether I see things the way that you see. A couple of my cousins are colorblind. I really colorblind. They can't see any colors. They don't know anything else. So their vision is presumably somewhat black and white, you know. It's just to say, when I have this strong experience of awareness, and I suddenly just realize, well, I think you guys are all sitting out there, but actually, when there's a strong sense of awareness, I just realize this is just an experience that arises within awareness. Mm-hmm. You know? And then that you said a lot of talking about, like, if you hear the sound of a bird, where is it? You know, is it outside of your mind? Then how can you contact it, isn't it? Or is it inside your mind? You know, how can the bird be, you know, fly away? It's, and with sounds, you can actually practice that very nicely. This sense of the sense of spaciousness of our presence. That's why I usually include that in the guided meditation. And it's generally a very good meditation object. I was told this is from the Zen tradition, where the very simple meditation instruction, where you just say, feeling the body and listening into the distance. Because the body, well, that's what we all tend to always advertise anyway. It's what, you know, grounds you into the intimacy of your immediate environment, the body. It's really, you know, getting you out of the mind, the thinking mind, the bubble of the thinking mind. But then listening to sounds, it can be very helpful, first of all, because sounds is something we cannot manipulate very well. We have very little or no control over it. So it's something that's very useful for observing this constant flow of experience, which is, you know, and giving up this fantasy or this tendency, this obsession of trying to manipulate, control our experience, which with the breath and with the body we can still do. Often people complain about that or ask about, well, if I observe my breath, it changes, you know. How do I observe my natural breath? And you can get obsessed about it if you've got an obsessive tendency. Mm-hmm. And he says, well, yeah, sure, you observe your breath, it changes, but it's not a problem. Mm-hmm. And just try not to, you know, press too hard or whatever. But with sounds, you can't do that. And that's also, and that's the sense of hearing is much less self-inducing as seeing. You know, seeing is our dominant sense usually, unless you're blind, obviously. But if you have a good eyesight, this is what most people certainly relate most to. And it's very focused. You know, we're looking for things and we locate things in place. And therefore always also makes them relate to me who is here, who's looking at things. And it's very active, you know, in many ways. Well, as if you examine seeing. But hearing is much more passive, you know, particularly for human beings. Our ears, as they are stuck on the sight, very different from the eyes, we cannot direct them our hearing very well. It's just this very passive sense. We can't close our ears either very easily, not like our eyes. And as you know, it's very difficult to locate a sound, actually. You get confused where sound is coming from. For meditation, that's an advantage because it gets you more into this open, receptive kind of state. You know, if you listen, that's often like a metaphor. Also, I suggest listen to your experience rather than looking for things. Because if I'm looking for things, it's always much more willed, much more directed. It's much more I'm doing something. Whereas if you're listening, you're receptive, and that it easier leads to the sense of just awareness, just being open, just receiving experience as it is. But then the other interesting thing with sound is that even though we find it difficult to locate sound, we always do that. You know? We always talk about this sound, like the sound of the train. Here can sometimes hear the train that comes from outside. If one of the people in the room speak, then the sound comes from closer by. You know, the bubbles in the belly or something, in the guts, then we might say that's an internal sound. You know? The train is an external sound. But actually, where is that sound? Well, if you look at it directly in your experience, it's again the same topic, coming back to awareness itself. If I really abide with an awareness, then the sound is just here, isn't it? Whether it's a train or it's my guts. With the guts, it's a bit easier to look at because it's connected to the body. So we've got direct physical experience of the extension. So let's say a bird, if a bird would fly in here and twitter in here in the room, or if one of you guys speaks, or the train, where is it? No, this is the Zen question. Is it outside or is it in your head? Or is it in the mind? Or is it outside the mind? No, obviously it arises within awareness. It arises in the same place where the body sensation arises. It arises in the same place where my thoughts arise. So in that sense, from the point of awareness, there is no internal or external. It's all here. No. And the internal, external, the same as me and other, over there, closer by or further away, that is actually something that we do. That is part that we do, that our mind does in creating the world in which we live to orient ourselves. Now, this is not to say this is entirely subjective. No. In order for that to be useful and to work, it has to correspond to some objective reality. No, otherwise it's going to lead us astray very quickly. But the way it appears to us, it has to do with the way we create the world through our mind. No. That's why the Buddha was always saying how nama rupa and consciousness, they lean on each other. In short translation, first approximation, like consciousness and the world, they lean on each other. You take one away, the other falls down too. It's like two sheaves of wheat. You take one away, the other falls too. You can't have one without the other. You're always conscious of something. And if there's something, it means you have to be conscious. That's why the Buddha was saying, if I talk about the world, I always mean the world which arises in this fathom long body. It didn't talk about a just independent, objective world apart from yourself. And that's a world in which you can experience liberation. That's the one that needs to be liberated. So external and internals are, to me, it's interesting in that sense, of course. And then also internal, external, self and other doesn't exist in that sense as an immediate reality for awareness. It applies across the board. Like when we practice metta, I was saying the same thing, kindness. As this is, we experience one reality. Either there is kindness or not. If you make a division about, supposedly or probably true for many Westerners, is that we often find it easier to be kind, feeling kind towards others than to ourselves, because we tend to be very self-critical. No, it can be a problem in kindness meditation, because whenever you look at the teachings of the Buddha on kindness, he's always talking about starting with yourself. Now, interesting, the reason for that, which the Buddha gives in the suttas, is because everybody loves themselves most dearly. That was just a given for the Buddha. He didn't say that's a problem because that's selfish or something. It's, he just said that's natural, human beings, of course. Who is most dear to me? Number one, it's me. The Buddha didn't say, oh, that's bad or something. He wasn't a moralist. He just said that's natural. And so that's why that's most easy to love yourself. Then you start there, and then you can expand it to other people. Now, that's Indian reality 2,500 years ago. Now you come to Switzerland 2,500 years later, or as it happened to Ajahn Sumedho when he came to England, and one of the first realizations he said is, well, he just noticed, well, these people need kindness. As the people are just so miserable and critical of themselves and everybody else. He started to teach a lot of kindness, metta. And there's a story where he went to the Buddhist summer school. It might have been again Ajahn Munindo who told me this story, but it would apply just the same to Ajahn Sumedho anyway. They had similar experiences. I think this is it. It was Ajahn Munindo went to the summer school with Lungpo Sumedho, and then Lungpo Sumedho, I think, put him on the spot, tell him to give some teachings. And he, emulating his teacher, was teaching on loving kindness and, giving a loving kindness guided meditation, starting with yourself, and then spreading it to other people. And he said then afterwards, this distinguished kind of English lady would walk up to him and just tell him off, saying, you don't do this in this country, you don't. You don't love yourself. That's selfish. Here you love your neighbor, but not yourself. That's suspicious. Somebody who loves another, that's a bit, conceited at least. It's interesting how it's different. But actually, if you practice metta, ultimately, if you're in touch with the experience of awareness of the heart, how can you distinguish? You realize if you do that, and we do that, of course, but it is something that we create, a division that we create. We compartmentalize, I love this one, or I can love outside, but I can't direct the same love to what I consider to be me or mine, I make this division, isn't it? Then this is again how self arises, the sense of self. You know, what is me, which is not worthy of love, and what is not me, which I can at least consider not to love, but what's inside the boundary, no way. Just an example, how self-view can arise. Where there's self, there's other. Where there's other, there's self. When self goes, there's no other. You know, other doesn't make any sense if there's no self. You know, and there's no other, there's no self. You know, it again, these are two sheaves of wheat that stand on each other. That's where this experience of, in some traditions, they emphasize unity. Like you are one with everything. That's quite popular in kind of modern spirituality, isn't it? It sounds more attractive than just there's no self. Said, oh, you know, that sounds dangerous. Help, you know. What do you mean? I'm here. But the good thing is, of course, no self, no other. It's the same. That's that experience of love, of unconditional love. You don't make a distinction. No, it doesn't make sense. Then you're in that position of awareness, truly in that position of awareness. Either there's love or there isn't. And then that's the same. If you practice awareness, mindfulness, if you really get deeper into it, then obviously you can also not compartmentalize it. I'm mindful of the breath, but I'm not mindful of, you know, of what I pick up, say, about somebody else's emotion. But again, it's interesting because saying this can balance, you know, this maybe this tendency about becoming self-absorbed in the practice, because you get that with mindfulness practitioners, vipassana meditators, Buddhist monks, me and my practice. It gets often leveled, no, at as a criticism at meditators that we are self-absorbed, you know, watching your own navel, things like that. But we can, of course. When we talk about being mindful, it's this thing about what are you actually mindful of? Mindfulness, as if that's awareness in expression, applied awareness, if you like, in action, has a tendency to undo boundaries, to overflow boundaries, isn't it? It's expansive by itself. Once you become more mindful, you start to pick up more and more. No, that's the danger of mindfulness. If you want to stay narrowly focused, it's going to start to erode those boundaries that you impose on it. But basically, we do that all the time. That's why maybe mindfulness just on its own is not enough, unless it's really fully developed mindfulness. No, because we are usually not aware of what we are not aware of. And usually we all have agendas. And those put the limits and boundaries on the mindfulness, what we allow ourselves to become mindful of. No. I always often use that example to illustrate, like with a mindful bank robber. Depending on what kind of view, how you use the word mindfulness, people have different takes on that. Like some people, my teacher, I remember, had a long time ago, before I became a monk, and was using it as an example, like the robber, the bank robber who for one reason or another meets a spiritual teacher and learns about mindfulness, wants to learn mindfulness, and then he has to stop his bank robbery because he becomes mindful of what he is doing. But I think that already implies that you put a few other qualities actually put in there, interpreted as being part and parcel of mindfulness, which in my way of thinking about it, I usually keep them apart. Like usually in the Buddhist teachings, when you talk about right mindfulness, it's always accompanied by other factors. Mm-hmm. Like in Pali, you have this sati, which is mindfulness, and sampajanya. So the Buddha then talks about sati sampajanya as right mindfulness. And sampajanya means, it's usually translated as clear comprehension. So that has this wisdom aspect of understanding. If you look at mindfulness just in itself, it seems to me it's more just a description of just being present, you know, being present with what you're doing, whatever you want to be present with right now. Mm-hmm. And it has this powerful quality, but first of all, because in being present, you've got access to this quality of awareness itself, which is truly liberating. And it gives you the possibility to actually investigate what you're doing. It became very popular in secularized contexts because whenever you're present with what you're doing, you're doing a better job, no matter what you do. So it's very useful in all kinds of realms of life. But basically, it just gives you information. the ancient commentaries, and they define mindfulness by saying the opposite of mindfulness is being distracted. So mindfulness, it's situated not in the wisdom section of categories in Pali Buddhism, but in the concentration section. It's a form of concentration, if you like, of collectedness, not on an object, but on the present moment, on what's actually present for you right now. But then any moment of consciousness, there's an endless amount of information available. No? So our mind by default is always selective of what we're actually taking in a certain moment. No? And so that'll also give a clue about how mindfulness is usually restricted by our interests, because what I'm taking in as an information depends on my interests, what I'm actually interested in, my preconditioning. You know, like the bank robber, if he wants to do a good job, I'm thinking about the traditional bank robber from the heist movie, you know, who goes in at night and opens the safe and things like that. He or she better be mindful, you know, because like with carpentry or anything else, if you're mindful, you do a better job. Mindfulness means you're present with what you're doing and you keep into account, it's usually described like that, you keep into account the things that are actually important for your task at hand, what you're doing. So the mindful bank robber will know where his or her tools are, what the plan is. It refers their experience, the information that mindfulness gives them to the greater plan, which is much like what you bring into the present situation, in order to then adjust your effort about what you're gonna do with what you perceive in the present situation. Mm-hmm. So the mindful bank robber is gonna be much more successful than the distracted bank robber, obviously, mm-hmm. because the distracted bank robber is gonna make mistakes, no? And then it's gonna get caught. The mindful bank robber, less likely. And if the bank robber notices something being wrong, if he or she is mindful, he will notice and then will respond to that. But what they do depends entirely on what they bring into the situation, what their plan is, what their interest is. Mm-hmm. Okay. That's why the Buddha sometimes talked about wrong mindfulness as well, not just about right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is defined through the right context. You know, what is actually the purpose of your action? So the bank robber's mindfulness by definition is going to be wrong mindfulness because of the interests behind it, which are unwholesome, which define what the bank robber is going to be mindful of, and also define what it's not going to come in. Because that which is not of interest, you know, to his or her purpose of successfully robbing the bank, is not even going to be allowed to come into the focus of mindfulness. When I use this example of the mindful bank robber, I usually then make the connection of saying that actually in some way or another, we are all bank robbers.
Yeah.
Because we tend to all use mindfulness selectively, mm-hmm. according to our own preconditioning and our programs, our interests, our preferences. And there's always a tendency of certain things that we don't want to know about. So we don't want to become mindful of. No, that is a warning, or a saying, like ignorance that the Buddha is talking about. It's not just a lack of information. It's an active force, you know, like denial. It's an aspect of ignorance that often we just don't want to know because maybe something's just too uncomfortable to know, to admit, or things like that. That's why I'm saying the danger of mindfulness is by its nature, it's expansive. You know, once you get into that stream, say, of mindfulness, you're becoming more mindful. Mm-hmm. That's the experience of the meditator. It gets refined. You start to pick up more and more things. No? So it starts to have to make actually consciously or unconsciously an effort to actually restrain it and say, well, I don't want to go there, you know. it actually costs energy, no, at some point to not open up anymore. It can be one reason. I'm not saying everybody who's falling asleep in meditation is doing that, but obviously sleepiness or tiredness in meditation can be one emergency measure that the mind can throw up in order to not find out. No, you just want to stay in your comfort zone. So you don't allow mindfulness to really just expand. Some things you just shut down. No? So it can be one of those famous resistances. No, that things, you know, sleepiness, torpor, can have a lot of different reasons, but that could be one of the reasons. So that's worth investigating. No? So in that sense, a hindrance to further development. It's a defense sometimes of the mind. You say, well, okay, up to here, it's okay to be aware, but don't go any further because it becomes too uncomfortable. So you'd rather go to sleep. Or to the meditator that is very, very mindfully washing the dishes, right? Some people confuse mindfulness with concentration and they think you have to slow down in order to be mindful. Well, Ajahn Chah was fond to say, if there's a tiger running after you, you can be very mindful and very quick. It doesn't have anything to do with speed, you know. But so then, you know, sometimes on a meditation retreat, people have to really slow down, which is okay in some contexts. But if you're, you know, doing the washing up and you've got 3-4 other people there who also, you know, they want the washing up to finish so that you can have a rest. And there's one guy there is just taking ages because they are mindfully washing the dishes. And then that's an example where you see that's the bank robber and the meditator, isn't it? There's a limitation. You might be very mindful of your play and the feeling, you know, of the soap bubbles on your skin. And I'd say exquisite, you know, what it's never been so pleasant washing dishes. But the other people around you, they're fuming, you know. And maybe because there's noble silence, they don't say anything. No, but there's hate building up around you. And you're maybe completely oblivious. No? And that's the thing. Be aware of you're doing that, maybe not in such a ridiculously strong way, but be doing that all the time. No? That's why mindfulness needs support. And we need to push those boundaries, push against those boundaries. That's why it's good to have spiritual friends or live in community. You know, because you find out I get you know, annoyed about other people doing things that are strange to me. Well, why don't you see that? You know, everybody, it's not important really to them, but they get annoyed about things that I do that I feel, well, but you know, it doesn't matter. You know, our view is of course already skewed, isn't it? Human beings tend to overestimate the capacities anyway, the psychological capacities. And we often do that, you know. We've got some moments of mindfulness and you think you're really, wow, you know, I'm really being mindful. Be careful. Because as somebody said, Mara's best tricks are always the ones that we don't even know about yet. Mara being the traditional Buddhist personification of delusion. Okay. Are monks better in quarreling than worldlings? They're just as good. You know, monks are just human beings. You know, if you become a monk or a nun, you have to give up a lot. Things that you wouldn't necessarily see so much there is, and you do find out when you try, that you do give up a lot. When I was a young monk at the beginning, I was still very idealistic. I just thought, I mean, this is the best thing. I mean, you can't do anything better with your life. And I was very much into proselytizing, or, you know, new people would come to the monastery. I would encourage them to become a monk. It's great. You know, this is wonderful. After a few years, I started to kind of, I rather warn people, you know, because I feel this is so difficult. It's rarely that you find somebody you feel, yeah, this is really going to work for you. There are some people where you feel, yeah, this fits. But usually I always warn people because it is different. It's always different from what you think it is. And it's almost always, 99.9%, it's more difficult than you think. And it's things that you don't necessarily expect. It's not necessarily the material things, you know, but it's that you don't have your private home anymore where you can close the door and don't pick up the phone if you don't want to. It's like, you know, living in community, it's tough. And while renouncing a lot of distractions at the same time, you have to be a monk 24/7. Our rules always apply. You don't get it, you know, time off or something. There are a lot of aspects, you know, there's a hierarchy, particularly if you're already older and you start, you know, at the bottom of the line as a novice. And you know, particularly if you already, you know, had some life experience and are suddenly kind of very junior monks who tell you what to do, and it can be very, very challenging. That we're saying you're giving up a lot, but you don't have to give up your opinions. So that's something that you can still hang on to. You know, a lot of like sensual dissatisfaction is going to taking away from you, you know, not only sex and all that, but also, you know, even like food, you know, you just have to eat what's offered. I mean, our food here is glorious, as you know. But at the beginning, it's quite difficult. It was for me, young man in his 20s, 11 o'clock, that was it. There's nothing anymore. And then he would work in the afternoon. And, there was a lot of despair about, hunger, weakness, and I'm going to have to work. It's cold and it's raining, Britain, I have to get out there and work. And then you come back and you can't just have some food. So then you're going to have to sit and meditate, maybe until midnight. And you can't just meditate when you feel like meditating. No, it's when, everybody else is meditating. It's just always this, the ego gets quite a beating. But if there's clinging in the mind, well, you look desperate for something to cling to. What can you still cling to? In Thailand, it's famous, monks cling to their nice kind of cool requisites, who's got the nicest bowl or, good, really cool robe or things like that. It becomes ridiculous. But the other thing is, of course, immaterial things, opinions, prime candidate, isn't it? So yes, monks and I suppose nuns can be wonderfully opinionated and really argue about details. The details of what our rules. great source of contention, whether it's allowable to drink soya milk in the afternoon or not, or why soya milk is allowable and rice milk isn't, and things like that. You'd be amazed about what monks can get into a fight about. But I'm confident that actually, lay people are certainly just as quarrelsome, isn't it? It's not, I don't think we are more quarrelsome, but it shows more. Because also it goes against that ideal that we might have, about, we get that everything, the monastery is so peaceful, And you are so lucky, you guys, you're living in that place all the time, this haven, because you come to the monastery and you're all on your best behavior. And it's, you're getting out of your stressful life. It doesn't always work, unfortunately, but it's laid out for there to be a refuge in that sense. But if you live here and you live with the same guys that you haven't really chosen necessarily all the time, it's not necessarily always peaceful. And one of the reasons I live in a small community is because if you live in a big monastery, you live with all kinds of characters there. And sometimes I can tell you it's pretty tough. It's pretty tough. And you can't get away from them. It's not like you've got difficult people at work and then you go into your car and you go home and you relax. And they, wow. No, they live right next to you. And every morning again, that's the other thing. If you're sitting according to seniority, this is how long you have been in the Sangha. Now, if you're in the same monastery for a long time with the same people, you're always sitting next to the same guys. And if you really have to have a problem, you happen to have a problem with the same guy, this can really get serious, Of course, this is meant to be like that as well. It's a good opportunity for practice, So this, it's a bit like with husband and wife, isn't it? It's difficult to get away from each other. Sure. So if there's a little thing that annoys you, it's going to be there again and again. So you better somehow deal with it, the problem you have about it, because if not, you're creating hell for yourself. It's very obvious. So that's the end of the line there for questions. I wish you all a good night's sleep, have a good rest, and then hopefully we can meet again tomorrow morning practicing mindfulness.